Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series.
You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Watch Hacks, streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Look out. His only films to be buried with.
Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I am a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, an ice bucket, and I love films. As Christina Westover once said, unrequited love is the infinite curse of a lonely heart. And Odd Numbers are the infinite curse of all the Star Trek films. I don't know if that's true. I mean, I think that used to be a rumour, but it's not something I'd sort of bet my life on. But fair enough, Christina, if it's that important to you, fair enough. Thank you. Thanks for joining in. Every week, I invite a special guest over. I tell them they've died. Then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. Previous guests include Barry Jenkins, Jameela Jamil, Kevin Smith, and even Bed Pambles. But this week, it is the brilliant writer, comedian, producer, mogul, and director, Judd Apatow. Get over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you get an extra 20 minutes of chat with Judd. We go deep, we talk beginnings, endings, there's a secret. You also get the whole episode uncut and ad-free and as a video. Check it out over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. Ted Lasso Season 2 is available on Apple TV+. You can watch that along with Season 1. And you can also watch Super Bob and Soulmates on Amazon Prime in most places. So, Judd Apatow, for God's sakes. Judd Apatow has been involved in one form or another in possibly, like, I mean, all of the things that you've loved in comedy in the last 30 years. I mean, all of them. He's pretty much, I mean, all of them. Do you know what I mean? Like, he was involved in The Larry Sanders Show, in Freaks and Geeks, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, This Is 40, The Gary Shandling Diaries, The King of Staten Island.
To Crashing, to Love.
All the things, I mean, there's too many things. Do you know what I mean? It's too much for one head to take in. But he done them all. His work is legendary. It's a real privilege to sit and talk to him for this long on the podcast. We'd met doing a gig together at the Largo, and the wonderful Mark Flanagan told Judd that he had to do my podcast. And because Judd is a polite man and he was right in front of me, he said yes. So I was very lucky that he did. We had a really great time. I think this is a lovely episode and I really think you're going to like it. So that is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy episode 188 of Films to be Buried With. Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. It is I, Brett Goldstein, and I'm joined today by a writer, a director, a producer, a documentarian, a book man, a stand-up, a Netflix specialer, a changer of the gamer, a lover, a fighter, a husband, a father, and one of the most influential men in American comedy. Please welcome to the show. Can't believe he's here. Could you believe he's here? He's really here. Please welcome, it's Mr. Judd Apatow.
Woo! Whoa! Thank you. That made me feel nice. I feel nice now.
Well, listen, I'm grateful you're doing this. Thank you for your time. I actually was making notes before this, and you're sort of one of the few people I've had on where I'm kind of annoyed because there's so much in your life and career that I want to talk about, and I know there's a limited amount of time. And so it's literally like I'm having to pick, like, what's the bit I can ask you about? Because you've done it all and you've done significant things a number of times. I don't know how that feels for you from a moment by moment basis. Do you just feel like, oh, nothing's happened. I'm just a guy in a hat.
I feel like they have enough for the in memorial reel.
Yeah. Yes. I think
that's how I look at it. Like, it's a good montage. It's a good montage. And so really that's all you care about in life is like when they cut to the montage, do you have the goods? You know,
that quick is a clip. Heck of a montage.
Right. You go to the chess whack shot and then you go to the me bombing on Evening at the Improv. You know, there's all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, fuck. Well, so you and I met at Largo doing a gig. I was very lucky to do a gig with Pete Holmes and you were on. And you had told me, I mean, can we talk about stand-up for a bit? Because
yes, please.
We're both interested in it. You have just written, you're about to release a new book, Sicker in the Head.
Yes, it's interviews with comedians, which is what I did when I was a kid. Just because I wanted to meet comedians. It was just an excuse to get near them, just to ask them how they do it. So the first book was maybe half and half interviews I did when I was 15 and new ones. And this one is all new ones except John Candy from 1984. And the funny thing is, for the new one, I did most of it during the pandemic. So I realized that everyone was home. So no one could say no to me because it's for charity. It goes to A26, this free tutoring and literacy charity. So when you call someone and you know they're home, you know they're bored, and it's for charity, they can't say no. And then the interviews were kind of intense and emotional because everyone was sitting home thinking about their lives and their journeys. So I was able to get people that normally I probably couldn't get, like Lin-Manuel Miranda and Letterman. So many cool people. Mindy Kaling did it, and Nathan Fielder, who you don't hear talk a lot about how he does that, and Sacha Baron Cohen, and just tons of people. So I'm psyched that it's out because the first one was the book I wish someone wrote when I was a kid. It didn't exist. And so I've seen with Sick in the Head, a lot of people really went through it with a highlighter and it helped them the way doing the interviews helped me.
What do you think it is? I was suddenly, when I was reading it, I got a chance to read some of it and it's brilliant, like the other one. But I was, it suddenly occurred to me, I was like, why does this work so well in print when they're interviews? Like, what, you know, you could equally, I guess, release the audio as a package or whatever, but it's so satisfying to read these things. Do you have a theory on that? I don't actually know why that is.
I don't know, because someone was making fun of me. They're like, so Judd, this is like a podcast written down. But when I did them as a kid, I used to joke, it's almost like I was trying to invent the podcast.
Yeah.
Because it's what I wanted. I wanted a long form interview with Seinfeld. If you love Seinfeld in 1983, there was no hour interview with Jerry where he talked about how he did it. So I did it for the radio. And that's the thing that I wanted. When you write it down, I think they work because I'm sharing my life in the conversation. It's not just me asking questions. And it's also one creative person asking another creative person how they do it. And we're both, you know, some of it is inside baseball of comedy, but a lot of it is emotional. And why do we want to be funny? Which I'm always fascinated by. You know, what leads us to feel like this is how we want to process the world?
When we first spoke, you were doing a bit of stand up, but you were doing more a sort of Q&A chat. And you said to me, if it's okay to share this, I asked you if you were planning a new special or what you were working on with stand up, and you said, I can't find. You say it, if you don't mind.
Yeah. Well, I said the pandemic made me confused about my stand-up point of view because I'm not sure if I'm sad or I'm angry or cynical or hopeful. I'm all over the place every day. So I can't figure out my stance. And I was kind of embarrassed to try to just do what I was in the middle of when the pandemic started, which was very domestic about my life and family and stories from show business, and it all felt kind of stupid. I'm slowly trying to see if it's okay to, you know, to just tell a funny story about someone that I bumped into or something that's happening with my kids moving out of the house and empty nesting. But it all felt so unimportant. Now, that's just in my head. I watch everyone else, like you and Pete Holmes. They're crushing it. They're great. No one is having the mental issue I'm having. But I'm about to host the Directors Guild Awards, so I have to do stand-up and a monologue only in front of Spielberg. So there's no pressure to do stand-up in front of Spike Lee and Steven Spielberg and Jane Campion.
Oh my
God. Now I have to get my shit together.
Oh, my God. How long have you got?
I have till the middle of March.
Oh my God.
And I've been going on stage doing like a DJ awards monologue at comedy clubs. So I have to say to the crowd, I know you're not directors and you may not understand or care about any of this, but I'm going to treat you all like you are 200 directors. And it's gone pretty well so far. I'm gaining confidence by the day.
Is that like date in the diary, is that something that's like a low-level anxiety that is residing in your brain at all times? Or is it like, I'll be fine when I get to it?
I think I would be very nervous if I hadn't done it a couple of times. This is the third time I've done it. So I have a sense of the crowd, and I think they're just happy that the show doesn't suck, is the truth.
Yeah.
You know, so for someone who's one of them to get up and talk about what it's like to direct, what it's like to direct during the pandemic and all the weird things about, you know, having to communicate to people with a mask on you. I mean, you've been through this. It's everything. Yeah. Adam Sandler said to me, shooting a movie during the pandemic basically removes every aspect of shooting that was fun. You can't kibitz with people and chat. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't have dinner afterwards. You know, when we made a movie called The Bubble that's going to be on Netflix this spring, and it was about the horrors of this time and shooting a movie during the pandemic. So in the movie, they're trying to shoot a dinosaur action movie, and it's a bunch of people stuck in a house. In a hotel in London, and the studio's pressuring them to finish this dinosaur movie, and it's about the isolation, how everyone loses their mind, so we've all lived that. I lived it so much that I had to make a movie about it. You know, I was having such a meltdown. I'm like, I guess I should make a movie about what this feels like right now.
Yeah, can I ask with you, given that you've sort of done all the things. You've done the writing, the stand-up, the acting. I don't know if you've done acting, have you? If you have, I apologize.
I've done small things. I'm not very proud of my abilities in that arena, but when called upon, sometimes I will hurt someone's project by making an attempt.
Okay. But you do all the things, and also King of Staten Island, which I fucking loved. I think it's a really beautiful film. I guess my question is, do you know what the thing that takes you to the next thing is? Like, is it an emotional connection to something? As in, when you're like, I'm going to produce this thing, I'm going to direct this thing, I'm going to stand up this thing. Like, do you know what the difference is for you that draws you in whatever role it is?
Well, sometimes it's just a love for comedy and certain comedy challenges. Like, you know, hosting an award show with all the celebrities there is the fantasy of every kid who loves comedy. So I'm never going to get asked to host the Academy Awards, but I'll get like the Producers Guild or the TGA. So it's like a mini version.
Yeah.
And you know what? No one sees it. I don't let them even stream it anywhere. Mm-hmm. So I get to do that. But a lot of times I find after the fact, I realize I made something because I was trying to work something out in my own mind. So I was attracted to talk about marriage because I was trying to figure something out, or I wanted to talk about death and mortality and cancer. And so I wrote Funny People, but I'm not exactly sure the specifics of it till almost a few years later when I watch it and go, oh, that's what I was working out. Yeah, I never realized till later that's what I was working on. Even the King of Staten Island, and I'm attracted to so many aspects of what Pete's story is. And I was very interested in firefighters and the idea of sacrifice, that there were people that weren't like me. They weren't egomaniacs looking to make people laugh and have a showbiz life. They're just willing to risk their lives to help other people. And I thought, that doesn't seem like what I would ever write about. So that should be where I should go. I'm interested in learning about that. But then later I realized that I was also dealing with divorce and step-parents and feelings I had as a kid adjusting, trying to get along with people, and that there were aspects that were very personal for me.
In terms of, like, I guess this is a question of ego, I suppose, but there's a difference between you've done lots of things where you have helped comedians, where they're front and stage, where you've made them stars, where you've, and I assume you have lots of joy in that. And then there's things where you do, which is more about you specifically, or more you've written, directed it. Are you happy in all of those positions, or do you ever find yourself being, I don't know, jealous or like, I want to be doing the...
I want to be Pete.
Yeah.
I definitely certainly have a level deep in me that goes, you never became Bill Murray. You know, I think that we all had that fantasy as a kid. We'd watch Ghostbusters and want to be a Ghostbuster or whatever. And I certainly have had to accept that people who are on screen are magic. They have a charisma. Why is Bono Bono? You know, what's the difference between him and just some guy in a local band? And people have something that's indefinable, and it's what draws us to people. And I always think, you know, if they have a 10 of that, I might have a 3. And, right. And 3 is kind of entertaining, but it ain't Jim Carrey, you know. And it's not Jerry Lewis. And on some level, I think most people in the world have to accept that they're not Johnny Carson. They're not walking around, you know, handsome and talented and hilarious, and everyone's fascinated by them. So yeah, there's definitely moments, but I also don't hunger for it enough, and never did, to really try to make that happen. I was just as amused, or close to just as amused, to write like a piece of stand-up for somebody like Jim Carrey and watch him annihilate in a way I knew I would never have the courage to even attempt. You know, right. There's a fearlessness to some of these people, to Adam Sandler or Amy Schumer, where when you see them do it, you're like, wow, that's just it's another level. It's like Michael Phelps versus like a high school swimmer.
People can swim. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got so many things to ask you, but maybe one other thing I may ask is you also made recently, or well, maybe not that recently, the Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling, which I think is a truly extraordinary piece of work. And if people listening have not seen it, I very much suggest you do. Like, it's a very deep dive into your late friend Gary Shandling, but it goes through his diaries. It's incredibly intimate, and it's very sad and very moving and real and honest and deep. And I wondered, for you making that and going through his diaries and stuff, how much of it was like, there's a level of kind of intimacy to that film that I think is rare, where it almost feels too much. It almost feels like, I don't know if we should be seeing this. Do you know what I mean? It feels so personal. And I wonder how that was for you making it, if I'm.
Well, making it was a process of grieving, because, you know, Gary was a mentor to me. And I think in a way, until he died, I didn't really realize how much of an impact he had on me. It just felt like such a massive loss. And I was putting together these little short video montages for his memorial service, which I put together. Mm-hmm. And then I quickly thought, oh, there's an amazing documentary in this footage. And it was hard to make. It took me months before I could really listen to his voice and listen to all the podcasts. It all just made me so sad. And I had an idea of what I thought some of his life was about, and I didn't know if I was correct, because it kept feeling like it was about the loss of his brother when he was a little kid and how his family handled it, which was by not really talking about it. Mm. And it forced him to internalize so much, and it led to a lot of issues in relationships and trust issues. But it was a guess. And then right near the end of the process, I opened up a diary that I hadn't found before. And there was a letter to his brother that basically said everything that I thought it was. Wow. And he said just what a profound effect that his brother had on him his entire life. And he says, I'll see you on the other side. It was a long letter. I put a little piece of it in the documentary. And I felt like Gary wanted something like this to be out there, but he hadn't figured it out in stand-up. And even in thinking about documentaries, Gary was trying to crack the code on this. And to me, it felt like finishing up a project that he had started, that this is what he would want you to take from his life. He would want you to learn from the messiness of his life. He leaned Buddhist. Yeah. And, you know, there's a thing in Buddhism, you know, use everything for the path, right? Use everything as a lesson. And although Gary was very private in life, I thought, now that he's gone, he would want people's lives to get better as a result of him having led this life. Although I could be wrong, he would be furious, We'll never know.
Well, it feels like I watched that film and I thought this, it feels like an act of love. Like it's a real, it's a love letter to a man, but it's also very even-handed. It isn't a, what, I don't know if this is the right word, hagiography?
It's not meant to just kiss his ass and say he's the greatest, because Gary was wonderful and giving and also a terror at times. Mm. And he, there were people he couldn't forgive. He was very hard on Bob Saget. You know, they had a falling out when Gary sued their mutual manager, and Bob Saget made a joke to a newspaper where he said, I'm going to sue him too because I need a Porsche. And that really hurt Gary's feelings. And in a way, he never made up with him the rest of his life because he thought that the joke made Gary look like he was just in it for the money and not for the justice of dealing with having been wronged by the manager. Mm-hmm. And Gary took it way too far. It was just way too far. Bob was in this terrible situation where he was tight with Gary and tight with his manager, and his manager was really there for him. And I'm sure Bob just nervously didn't know what to do. And Gary, even as a Buddhist, even as a person who should think all Dharma is dreams and nothing is really that important, he held a grudge. And that's what the movie's about. It's not saying that he's perfect. Sarah Silverman said Gary needed Zen. He needed this. It wasn't that he was Zen. He needed Zen.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, absolutely fascinating.
We're doing another one now about George Carlin.
Oh, really?
A two-part documentary with my partner, Michael Bonfiglio. And it is so different. Also because I wasn't friends with George Carlin. So
right. Is it easier? Is it easier to be more, to just go, this is a good bit?
I was scared I couldn't capture it because I didn't know him, but his daughter, Kelly Carlin, has done a lot of interviews with us, and she's a big part of it and one of the producers, and we're just finishing it up, and it's a very different life, but is an equally deep dive. And then ultimately it's about almost the prophecy of his stand-up. Everything that we're going through today, he had a bit about 20 years ago.
Can I ask you one more thing, and then I promise we'll talk about films. Curious again, when you look at your career, you made a load of amazing stuff that wasn't necessarily successful. You had a period of sort of stuff that people loved that didn't make money or was considered not successful. There was a whole period of that. Then you hit big. Basically, my question is, the stuff you made when you weren't as successful, if I may, is really, really good. In your head, was there any difference between what you did before and after, let's call it, big success? Or is it just luck and timing?
It's hard to say. I mean, hopefully I'm getting better, but there are things you do when you're young because you don't know any better, and that's why they're good. So we did The Cable Guy, and at the time, because it was a dark comedy, it was considered a disappointment. But yet, on the Super Bowl, there's a Cable Guy commercial, and we made that movie in 1996. So, so it's 26 years later, that character is alive enough in the culture that it's mad, a Super Bowl commercial. And I remember Gary Shandling was friends with Warren Beatty, and Cable Guy wasn't doing well and got really bad reviews. And we were surprised because we thought people would appreciate that we were taking all these risks creatively. Yeah. And Warren Beatty said to me, you don't know if a movie is good or means anything to people for 10 years after it comes out. Then you'll know if they're still talking about it. Then you'll know where it really landed. Like Harold and Maude was a big bomb when it came out. Mm. And so the fact that 26 years later, people think it's funny enough that they want to still talk about it, and the Blu-ray comes out and there's anniversaries of the movie. But still it's a lesson because Stiller and I are making a movie. We don't really even know how to make a movie. And so we're doing all sorts of crazy things that it's still debatable if they were the right choices or not. Too light, too dark. You know, what are we saying? But I think that movie, it was about losing your mind due to reliance on gadgets. That was the point. Like I had literally, and he says, let's kill the babysitter. That's the end of the movie. And him jumping to land on the satellite dish. It doesn't work. He doesn't shut the satellite dish down. But there is that moment where everyone's TV goes out.
Yeah.
And then someone just picks up a book and reads a book. I'm trying to, I might be even Kyle Gass from Tenacious D is the one that reads the book.
Wow.
But that was, you know, the point of the movie. And then Freaks and Geeks, you know, was Paul Feig's vision. And we all tried to make a contribution about what happened to us in our childhoods in it. And for me, I always think, I don't know why that came out so well. That there was some strange kismet or, you know, magic to that, that we were just really passionate about it. You know, and obviously Paul had a very clear idea what he wanted to do. And I always thought, well, at least that happened. You know, and then anything I did after it.
It's still, people still talk about it. It's still.
Yeah, and it's like.
A lot of people's favorite thing.
It's like, we didn't even know what, we had never done an hour TV show. Mm-hmm. But afterwards, I always thought, I'm going to treat every project like the thing after the great thing that worked. So, like, I'm allowed to take a big swing because Freaks and Geeks worked. So it's okay if I fail on the next one. And I've done that for every project since Freaks and Geeks. Because I thought, right. Oh, well, that's our Sergeant Pepper. So at least we did one thing amazing in our whole careers. And everything else can be like, we might do it again. But if we don't, it's actually okay. Because somehow that happened. Wow. And that's just a mental trick for me not to put too much pressure on myself. So I really allow myself to fail every time. I don't want to be safe. That's the key.
Judd, I've forgotten to tell you something. And I feel like an idiot because we've been talking for about 20 minutes. And I probably should have said it at the beginning. And I don't even know how you're going to take this. But I'll just say it and we'll deal with the fallout afterwards. I'm so sorry. I just have to say it. You've died. You're dead.
Oh, man. Shit. I thought this would happen at some point.
Yeah. What happened? How did you die?
I was walking down the stairs in the middle of the night because I realized I didn't bring the dogs in, and a cat was on one of the steps. And when my foot hit the cat, I was like, oh, don't step on the cat. And then I just fell backwards and wiped out, and that's how I died. Trying not to hurt my cat. And I have four cats. Like, I don't need four. I could have three cats. But my instinct was to care about the cat more than me.
I love that as a Hollywood screenwriter, you died saving the cat.
Yes. That's really funny. I hadn't thought about that. That is correct. That is what happened.
A perfect death. Do you worry about death?
Yes, I'm very bad on death. My parents weren't religious. They never talked about religion ever. And there was no discussion of the afterlife ever, which has left me with a gaping hole. And so I'm very interested in Buddhism and the idea of accepting it, accepting everything. Like, there is no time. My body lives in time, but I do not live in time. But then I never really fully believe it. But I'm trying. I'm trying to have something. But I don't have a good enough answer that lets me sleep well at night. So what I'm also trying to do is accept my own death. So, like, when I'm on a plane and I take off, I don't, like, try to live. I always say the same thing, like, that was a pretty good ride. I guess that was it. And then I get less nervous. And I think in life, that's what I'm trying to do, to just go like, okay, that was enough.
So you're treating everything like you treat Freaks and Geeks, like the next project, the next day. I had a pretty good day. So now it doesn't matter what happens. If I die, I had a good day.
Exactly. I that's the only way I think to feel a little bit better. You know,
I really like that. That makes sense to me. Do you think anything happens when you die?
Thich Nhat Hanh, who is the big Buddhist monk that a lot of people read his books, like Pieces, Every Step. He has all these amazing books. And he just says, I'm not dead. Like, I'm in you. I'm in your thoughts. Every time you breathe, I'm there. I'm in the trees. I'm the leaves. And I think that's a beautiful idea. That doesn't work at all for me to feel better.
Yeah. Not remotely comforting, but yeah.
I don't want to be in a leaf, okay? I get it. I get what that means. We're all energy. We're all changing and moving constantly. But I would like to be here. I don't want to be in a cricket. I don't want to be like a piece of, some sort of living fungus in dirt. None of that feels good to me. So I don't know, but someone said to me once, you have to love the mystery. And so that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to love the mystery because I think Pete Holmes has an incredible bit about it. I'm paraphrasing and doing it wrong, but he basically says people talk about, like, how could there be a heaven? And Pete said, well, how can there be this? And then he's like, we're on a planet moving 20,000 miles an hour, yet we don't fall off of it. Yet, you know, like, he has an amazing bit, which I think actually is true. Like, who knows?
Well, I know.
I'm glad you know.
Don't worry about it. It's actually, okay. I think you're going to like it. There's a heaven, straight up heaven.
Thank God. And I was filled, hoping you'd say that.
It's filled with your favorite thing. What's your favorite thing?
I guess it's movies, right? I guess we're going to talk about movies.
Can
it
be.
Could be. Yeah.
Unless you want to change the format. I'm ready to yes and.
Okay.
It's they're very excited to see you in heaven. They're all big fans of all of your work, but they want to talk about your life.
Yes.
They want to talk about your life through film. And the first thing they ask you is, what is the first film you remember seeing Judd Apatow?
The first film I have a memory of watching was a movie called The Phantom Tollbooth.
Yes.
And it was, I believe it was like real people. And at some point they went through like a toll booth and it became animated.
Correct. I remember this film.
I don't remember much more about it. I have located it at times where I could watch it, but have made some choice not to watch it because it's like so magical in my mind.
Yeah.
But that's my first memory of a movie. I mean, you know, my family as a kid would buy the first like VHS tapes. Nice. So right when it was invented, we had the VCR, you know, mid 70s. And we only really had about like 10 or 12 movies. You know, it really was like Godfather, Part 1 and 2, Annie Hall, French Connection, 10.
Ten.
Movie 10. And The Pink Panther. I mean, so for a while, there was like 6 and then 8. And our whole life was those movies. So it's like a little kid.
Wow.
Like a little kid, you know, 10, 8. I'm like watching The Godfather a lot. <You know? laughs> And then all the Woody Allen movies, you know, we all feel bad talking about Woody Allen these days.
Yeah.
But truly, that was just the heavy rotation was all those movies at that time up through Manhattan was what we would watch constantly.
Are you an only child?
I have an older brother and a younger sister.
Okay.
But behaved like an only child a fair amount. Sat alone a fair amount.
So you watched The Phantom Tollbooth at home on TV is your first memory of it?
No, it was in the theater.
In the cinema. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And did you think, I want in on this?
I don't think I ever really thought I wanted in on movies. I wanted in on stand-up. That's right. The strange part about me. I didn't really make a movies adjustment till I was in my 20s. I didn't pay any attention to movies as a kid. Like, I wonder what lens Coppola's using on this shot. I didn't care at all. I liked movies, but I didn't think about being a director ever. I didn't think about writing them ever, really. I just thought I'd love to be in that world of the National Lampoon people and the Saturday Night Live people, like Stripes. I'd like somehow to be in that.
Yeah.
I don't know how it happens, and I want to be friends with those people. I want to have a group like that. But I don't think I had a clear vision, and I wanted to be on stage like Jeff Altman or Jerry Seinfeld or Gilbert Gottfried. That was the dream, to be a stand-up comedian. Then later, friends would get successful, and suddenly they'd be like, should we try to write a movie? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I went to college for that, I think.
Really?
I did 18 months of screenwriting at USC. I think I know the format. I remember I sold a movie pitch when I was very young.
Mm-hmm.
And then afterwards, it seemed like, oh, they bought it. They like it. I went downstairs to a bookstore and bought How to Write a Screenplay. And then the people I had pitched it to walked into the bookstore, and I had to hide that I was buying the book.
You shouldn't have just signed it. I'm just signing this. I wrote this one. What's the film that scared you the most? Do you like being scared? You've never made a horror.
I tried. I've tried to write some horror. I don't know if it's my move because I really have made some attempts to produce and help with horror. And I've never really assisted well. Bill Hader was writing a horror movie years before Trainwreck. And it was a great idea. It really was funny. But I don't think I had the chops in the world of horror to give the appropriate guidance to get it to where it was shootable.
But do you like horror yourself?
I don't. I'm not like a big fan of horror because I don't love being in this state of terror. I will watch it. You know, I love what Jordan Peele's doing, and I've seen a fair amount of it. And my kids like it, and they'll make me watch it. But it's not where I go to for fun. I actually like a scary movie more than a violent horror movie.
Yes,
so I'm not attracted to like chopping people up. But if there's like a movie and someone said like it's really scary, like Babadook, I'm all about the Babadook. That kind of thing I like a lot. But the movie as a kid that scared me the most was probably The Fog, the original version of The Fog. And also When a Stranger is Calling, because that idea of like, the call is coming from inside the house.
Yeah.
That freaked me out. But the movie The Fog had these, like, I don't remember if it was like pirates or something. Some like coming through the fog into the town to murder everyone. I'm sure I'm getting all the details wrong.
Yeah, no, but a fog comes in and people, like ghosts are in it, like from the past. I don't know if they were pirates. They might have been sailors, but they're not happy.
They're not happy. But When a Stranger Calls was the first one where I was like, oh my God.
Yeah. When a Stranger Calls is amazing. And also amazing to string an hour and a half film out of the concept, he's in the house.
Yes.
The call is coming from the house. And it's like, they make it last.
Was that Carol Kane was in that
movie? Yeah.
Right? Carol Kane. And I also was really scared, like the scariest kind of movie thing was in Woody Allen movies, he talked about his fear of death. And he had the little boy, and he's just like, well, if the universe expands, you know, why does it break apart? Or, you know, there was a lot of what's the point of living type jokes. And as a little kid watching way too much of that, it planted seeds of terror in me.
That's interesting. What about crying? What's the film that made you cry the most? Are you a crier?
I love to cry. I'm a sucker. I'll cry during a commercial. I'll cry randomly during anything.
And you'll cry in life, in public, in like you're not shy about it, or are you?
Yeah, I'm okay. I mean, I won't hold it in the setting where it is appropriate. I mean, Terms of Endearment is just a cry fest. The scenes near the end with Deborah Winger in the hospital. And then at the very end, Jack Nicholson is taking care of the boy at the funeral. And then he walks into his house and he says, you want to see my pool? And there's something about it that just makes you bawl that this man who is all about himself, who's so self-involved, cares about this kid. And I remember I asked James Brooks about that scene. And I said, it's just such a magical grace note at the end of this story. How did that happen? Is that improvised? And he said, you know, we were going to shoot the funeral scene. And I said to everyone on the movie, there is a Rothko Museum where we are. I don't know if they were in Dallas or in Texas. And you should go look at these paintings. And I guess he was trying to get people in the spirit of mourning for the funeral. And you should go there to prepare. And he said, no one went but Nicholson.
Wow.
Yeah. And thus you get, let me show you my pool. But ending a movie on a very small gesture of kindness.
Yeah.
You know, I found very, very powerful. And for some reason, I cried during the last 20 minutes of Punch Drunk Love. I just bawl, like, I can't stop crying. I connect to it so much. And, you know, I lived with Adam Sandler. And when he was making the movie, he's like, I'm kind of doing an impression of you and my brother. And I would watch the movie and I could see like what he's making fun of, which at core was like my insecurity that he observed when we lived together, when we were in our early 20s. And I was just like terrified around women. And there's a funny moment where he's like talking about, he's on a date and he's trying to explain something funny a DJ said. and he's just bombing at the table. And I'm like, that's like my entire early 20s.
Table bombing is the worst bombing.
Yeah. So psychically, I felt so connected to the loneliness of that character that I would just lose my mind sobbing watching the end of it. Because I was happy he found love, even though he seems somewhat crazy and broken.
He seemed not well. I think it, I don't know what it was on. Maybe it was on the Pete Holmes podcast. Or was it with you? I don't know. Where James Brooks was talking about the end of As Good As It Gets and how that was just sort of made up, just improvised. They were trying to find an ending. They did. I think they had like three nights of just kind of playing around. And then I think he just shouted, "Kiss her," from behind the camera. And I think he said, "I'll do it better next time," or whatever exactly that line is. And that's the line in the film.
And it was an improvisation from Nicholson.
Yeah, I think it was like a kind of genuine moment of the kiss wasn't great. I'll do it better next time. And it was like, no, that works for this.
Yeah, it's like the end of The Graduate. Can I tell you something nuts about that?
Please.
I was on the set one of those nights.
No, tell me.
Owen Wilson, I believe, was a co-producer on that movie.
Yeah.
James Brooks was one of the producers of Bottle Rocket, and he hired Owen to, you know, be someone that he turned to be part of the creative discussion of the movie. I'm not sure exactly what Owen's services were, but he was, you know, part of the creative team on that movie, and I went to visit the set the night they were shooting that.
No way.
I wasn't really wearing the headphones at the monitor with Mr. Brooks. I was very far away, just terrified. But I was there. And James Brooks is the person that, you know, I've always learned so much from.
Yeah.
You know, what he did in broadcast news and in all, so much movies and television and The Simpsons. And it's really the thing that I try to be very aware of is the humanity underneath the comedy. And he always talks about that you have a responsibility to the characters you create. I love thinking about it that way. That's like they exist and you have to do right by them. You can't be lazy. You have to come through.
God, I really like that. Tell me this. What is the film that you love? People don't really like it. It's not critically acclaimed, but you don't care what anyone says. You love it unconditionally. Judd Apatow, what is it?
Well, the movie that I like that maybe not everyone loves.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was a kid, Caddyshack came out and it got 2.5 stars in New York Newsday. It was the first time I saw a movie that I worship get a bad review and where I understood that, oh, maybe reviewers aren't always correct.
Yeah.
And that was the abuse of Meatballs and Caddyshack was a big thing. There is a movie that makes me laugh so hard, not to keep talking about Sandler, but Jack and Jill makes me laugh so hard. I don't know where people think it stands in the canon of Sandler, but I brought my kids to the premiere. I've never laughed harder. I was just wall to wall losing my mind. And again, I think the culture caught up to it with the Pacino stuff and the donut commercial and all that, Dunkachino. But my kids kept looking at me like, what is wrong with you? And what was making me laugh the most was I could see in Adam's eyes the glee he was getting from doing it. There was just a joy in playing the female part that it made me giggle so hard. Because every choice he made, I would imagine him thinking of how to do it. So I was having a multi-level, just ridiculous laugh fest watching it. And also, it's so proud to just go, I'm going to do anything to make you laugh.
That is a perfect answer. I felt the same way about That's My Boy. Which
hilarious.
I know was very badly received, and fuck, it's funny. I mean, we laughed. I mean, say what you like, I was laughing all the way through it.
People don't realize how hard it is to just try to make people piss their pants.
Yeah.
To try to figure out what those levers are that get you to a place where you really laugh hard and you're shocked and it just gets you in a Mel Brooks riotous way. That's like my favorite thing. When people are just going, I'm going to try to destroy you right now. I'm so excited to see Jackass Forever.
Right,
because
Yeah.
I know what's coming. I know I'm going to be so happy.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series. You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with Hacks writer and actor Pat Regan, on how their improv experience helped them when shooting scenes and what it was like writing scripts for specific actors.
You'll also hear from crew members like the costume designers on what it was like creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Hear stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and more. Watch Hacks streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
What is the film that you used to love, but you've watched it recently and now you don't like it, but that can be for personal reasons or whatever?
It might be Author.
Go on.
Al Pacino as a writer, Diane right. Cannon, a lot of kids. There's like he has a lot of kids, Al Pacino. They all have the manner of David Krumholtz as a young actor. But as a kid, I kind of loved that movie and I watched it again. And I thought maybe as a kid, I like thought I was like being sophisticated with an adult movie, but maybe not the masterwork. Now, I'm not saying it's not solid, but in my mind as a kid, I felt like I'm smart. I like Author.
It's a real title and it makes you sound smart. I get that. Yeah. What's the film that means the most to you? Not necessarily the film itself is any good, but the experience you had around seeing the film that will always make it special to you.
You know, I went and saw Diner with my mom when I was a kid. You know, my mom was no longer with us and my parents got divorced and she, you know, she moved away and she was working as a waitress at a diner in the Hamptons. And she was very upper middle class and was really bummed that she had to do that.
Right.
And I was proud of her. I thought it was cool. Like, oh, my God, you're just working hard to take care of yourself. And she was really bummed, but was so nice and funny. And people probably loved her as a waitress. Yeah. But really the last person in the world you would think of who would have to support herself in that way. And she took me to see Diner like after she worked. And she fell asleep the entire time. And I just remember watching Diner, and my mom's just exhausted from trying to make a living.
Yeah.
But was, for me, even though she had no gas in the tank, took me to Diner.
How old were you at the time?
I was probably 14 or 15.
So you stayed with your dad and your mom moved away. Is that what happened?
Yeah.
If I may ask.
And that wasn't something that happened.
Yeah, you know, that's
so unusual, it was all very traumatic. But when I think of moments where my mom was really trying to be there for me, you know, that's a big one. And then that became a movie that influenced me an enormous amount because Barry Levinson, you know, he's a great storyteller. And he told personal stories about his childhood, about his friendships. Mm. And I think that he's much more influential then people realize that all of this Tarantino speak and Seinfeld, that a lot of the earliest incarnations of that was created by Barry Levinson in Diner.
Yeah.
You know, that's where we saw just people talking about a roast beef sandwich.
Yeah.
And Paul Reiser is, you know, asking who's better, Mathis or Sinatra. And he used comedians, you know, he had Paul Reiser and he let him improvise, which I was very influenced by. And I thought, wow, Paul Reiser wrote most of his lines. That's incredible. But it made it so real to how people talk when they hang out. I think later movies and TV did that, but I can't really think of places that did it as well before Diner.
And it's not for nothing, as in there's that incredible, I think it's one of like the all-time great scenes with Daniel Stern and Ellen Barkin where he's saying, you never ask me about the B-sides of all these records. You never ask me about the B-sides. And it's this, you know, on the surface, it's a funny conversation about, I care about stuff you don't care about, but really it's about their marriage, It's an amazing bit of writing that, like, you never ask me about the B-sides. I don't give a shit. She's like, what the fuck do I care? I don't care about the B-sides.
And the sports tests.
Yeah.
Steve Guttenberg makes his fiance take a test and he won't marry her if she doesn't know everything about sports.
It's so good. I didn't know that about your mum. And it's explained all the things that you've been asking the question of, why do you do comedy? It's like, well, I get it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It all starts coming together.
What's the film that you most related to, Judd Apatow?
I mean, I related to Fast Times at Ridgemont High as a kid. I liked seeing the hierarchy of the high school.
Right.
When we did Freaks and Geeks, Paul Feig, he never like looked at Welcome to the Dollhouse and Fast Times as influences. But to me, they were my influences as his partner. Yeah. And I always thought about, you know, the kid who worked at the movie theater and his friend sold the concert tickets and he was the nerdy one. And I was like, I feel like that kid. I'm that kid at the movie theater. And that was very meaningful to me. And that the people in it spoke the way we spoke, and Judge Reinhold's character, it felt like someone had captured, you know, what it felt like in the mid 80s to be in high school. And actually, it was written by Cameron Crowe, who went undercover in a high school and wrote a book about what happened.
Yeah.
And then he wrote a screenplay of the book, but he really did it. And he's one of the people I interview in Sicker in the Head, and I ask him a lot of questions about that.
I'd like to know about that. All right. Okay, I'm going to read that section next. Judd Apatow is the one people tune in for. What's the sexiest film you've ever seen, and is it by Derek and Ten?
I mean, that was a movie that I don't remember any of, because I love Dudley Moore. I just remember as a kid thinking, I wish there was less adult stuff in this and more silly Dudley Moore.
Interesting.
I didn't like hunger for the adult Blake Edwards aspects. I was like, I'd like Dudley Moore to be going nuts a little bit more. but the more Arthur type humor.
Yeah.
But as a kid, I think the sexiest movie was probably Body Heat.
Yes.
I mean, that was the one where you're like, well, that's as hot as a movie can get. Yeah. I could not create scenes like that in a movie. I get uncomfortable when I have to have anyone be sexy or sexual. I'm working through my own issues when I'm trying to present those types of scenes. But when I look at that, I think, well, that is a commitment. Lawrence Kasdan, the great Lawrence Kasdan, made that movie.
Good film.
And he, I don't know. I can't think of another scene in anything that's like that. What else would even compare?
I'll email you a list. There's a subcategory to this question. Troubling boners, worrying wide-ons. A film you found arousing that you weren't sure if you should.
That's a very good question.
Thank you.
You know, I might say Sharky's Machine. You remember Sharky's Machine?
The
Burt Reynolds. Maybe it was Rachel Ward in Sharky's Machine. There was this Canadian movie. I can't ever remember the name of it, but it was about a guy who was like a extra, you know, he was atmosphere in movies, a wannabe actor, wasn't doing well. And he plays a cop in something and he steals the uniform and starts like going around town acting like a cop and like being more and more aggressive about that. Just like telling people to get out of the way and, you know, giving people tickets, even though he's not a cop. And I remember there was some sort of romance in that movie with a Canadian actress. And I can't remember it. I can't remember what it looked like, but I remember being fascinated by it. And someone's going to message you and tell you what that movie is. It's a Canadian movie.
It's not the film Let's Be Cops.
No, it's like a drama. It's like a troubling version of Let's Be Cops from like 10 years before that.
And it's not Miami Blues. It's not Miami Blues.
It's not Miami Blues.
Okay. That is a good mystery for us. Judd Apatow, what is objectively the greatest film of all time? Might not be your favorite, but objectively it's the greatest.
I mean, when I think of perfect movies, It's always like there's like two or three. I can't get it exactly right. Being there is usually on the top of my list.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's a miracle of a movie. It holds up. I mean, I think all through the Trump administration, people referenced it. And it's a Jerzy Kaczynski novel that it was based on. I think my grandfather did the development for John Frankenheimer, the director, when he was like in his 60s or late 50s. And there was a period where I think they claimed they owned that book and then they lost the option to it. But Peter Sellers couldn't be funnier. The scenes with him and Shirley MacLaine, the scene where they're like watching television and he's trying to copy what's on the TV and she thinks like they're having a sexual moment. I mean, it's the greatest comic set pieces of all time and then has a much deeper meaning. And then I always think about Cuckoo's Nest. In terms of endearment and broadcast news are always right up there. And then I always think about the movie, in addition to like Godfather movies and Goodfellas, there's a movie called A Prophet,
which was a French movie.
That I just, when it ended, I'm like, you can't do it better than that. You can't. It's as good as it is, you know.
So which is your answer? Gun to head.
I'd say being there.
You can have it. Chad Apatow, what's the film you could or have watched the most over and over again?
The movie that I've seen more than any other movie. That's a good question. What have I watched over and over again that I want to watch over and over again? Maybe, oddly, Groundhog Day. Another perfect movie.
Yeah.
You know, we made a movie called Year One with Harold Ramis, and we were all excited to just be around him because he loved to answer questions. He would tell you all the stories very happily. Oh, he was the nicest man and the greatest hang. But that is as good as a comedy film can get. And you can watch it over and over again and always find new things about it.
Yeah. I have a question for you. When you're making films, and I think I read something – correct me if I'm wrong. I think this is what you said in an interview, and I really liked it. Is that someone was saying, "All your films are so long. Why are they so long? Cut them down." And you said something like, "Because I like all the bits. I don't want to cut it down." Is that true? Well, is that right?
Well, there's usually a moment in the editing where you realize, as a whole, this might play better at an hour and 48. But the 16 minutes I would have to cut to get you there is the thing that makes the movie really good.
Yeah.
And so I feel ahead of my time in not caring about time because, you know, people will sit down and watch like 7 episodes of Yellow Jackets in a row. So why won't you watch a 2-hour and 7 or 11 minute movie? Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people will be like, oh, it's, you know, comedies need to be 90 minutes. So comedy is worth less of your time than a spaceship or a superhero.
Thank you.
I remember someone said to me, I think it was James Brooks, who he said, you know, when your movie's a little bit longer, you're saying these people are worth your time.
That's very nice.
And that's how I like to look at it. And I have watched movies later and go, God, I wish I found that 10 minutes.
Really?
And sometimes they ask me to cut it down because I have to because it's going to be on ABC or something, and they're like, well, you only have this much time, so you need to cut 12 minutes for it to fit on network television. And I do, and every once in a while I'm like, yeah, it might be better that way.
when you're making, I can't remember this from, how often do you think when you're in the edit, did you watch the film, let's take This Is 40, which I love, by the way. How often do you think you watch that film from beginning to end in the edit rather than working on bits where you just sat back, watched it as a whole? Do you have any estimate?
You have to be careful because your brain can only handle so many full watches. So I'll fix hunks of it for months and months, having maybe watched a long 2-hour and 40-minute assemble at the beginning of the process once, and then I won't watch it all together. I'll just watch, you know, they cut it into like 6 reels. And then at the preview, when I watch it with an audience, that's when I watch it. I rarely watch the whole thing by myself without an audience.
Great.
But then when I'm with the audience, I really like rest up and get focused. And I try to see if I can have the experience of the audience. which is hard because you lose all the mystery and the tension of, I wonder what'll happen. So in a way, as a filmmaker, you never get to watch it the way another person feels when they watch it. So you almost can't edit your movie correctly. You're trying to edit your movie based on math, based on story dynamics that you're being very intellectual about. But when someone watches a movie, you know, sometimes you think, oh, I wonder if they're going to be worried if they're going to kiss. But really what they're worrying about is he's going to murder her. Like, you don't know what people think when they don't know what's coming. And sometimes you'll test the movie and they'll be like, I really thought he was going to kill her. And you're like, I didn't intend that at all. I thought he looked like he just liked her. And that's something that you have to have a conversation with the crowd to say, where was it boring? Where is it slowing down? How are you experiencing this? I'm actually excited because there's a lot of my movies I haven't watched in 10 years or more. Mm-hmm. And I can begin to try to watch them to see if I can get a feel for them as an audience member.
Amazing. Judd Apatow, what's the, I don't like to be negative for too long, what's the worst film you ever seen?
I think the worst movie I've ever seen was a kids movie. I used to have to watch all the kids movies when my daughters were younger. And there was a movie called Bratz, B-R-A-T-Z.
Yes.
And every second of it was like being in the dentist chair. It just, time was moving backwards. And it all felt like an excuse to make a toy into a movie. It felt like a money play. And I could be wrong, but on that particular day, I suffered more than I can remember ever suffering in a movie.
And did they love it? Did your girls love it?
I don't even think they loved it. You know, a lot of times when you take your kids to movies, it's just a Sunday time killer. Right. Like, your kids are bored and you're like, okay, an hour and a half of this will be this movie, then we'll go get Chinese food. And so you wind up seeing a lot of movies that you wouldn't want to see. But it is sad because now that my kids are, you know, 19 and 25, I don't go to kids' movies anymore. I don't watch them. And I watched them for 20 years, everything, every single kids' movie that came out. And like, I was home the other day, I'm like, should I watch this cartoon? And I didn't. And I'm like,
you should.
Maybe I just start watching kids' movies alone. Is that weird and creepy to just sit by yourself watching those movies? I don't know.
You'd have to ask my neighbor if she thinks it's weird and creepy that I do. You're in comedy. You're a comedian. You've made some of the great comedies. What film made you laugh the most, Judd Apatow?
I mean, the movie that makes me laugh more than any movie, I mean, there's a couple of experiences. I remember watching Young Frankenstein in a theater at a revival house 20 years ago, having never seen it with a crowd, and the place just losing their shit wall to wall. Just the laughs were crazy, and that was fun. The biggest laughs I remember in a theater, one was Airplane when it came out, like the weekend it came out. So I saw that as a very young man, and it was a barn burner. It just, it made everyone so happy, and people laughed so hard. And the other one I remember, well, there are two others. Something About Mary, I went to see with Ben Stiller on opening night, just in the hiding in the back in Santa Monica. And that was so fun. It's so fun to see it with Ben. I was just so happy for Ben. And it inspired so many movies and so many of our movies. But the one that was the craziest was we went to see Borat. The first time Sasha showed his friends to get thoughts and notes. So it was like 25 minutes longer than it ultimately was. There were set pieces in it that he cut out. There was a whole scene like shooting a porno that was just so crazy and troubling. And that may have hit some DVD, actually, I don't know. And the scene where he has the naked fight, there was nothing covering the ball. So it was way longer and way more aggressive about like just the guy's balls and penis on Sasha's face, just rubbing on his face. And, you know, it was a true fall out of your seat, you know, spit up whatever you're eating or drinking moment. And then when it ended, George Meyer from The Simpsons was there.
And
he just said, I feel like I just listened to Sergeant Pepper for the first time. It's my second Sergeant Pepper reference.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's the nicest compliment you ever can get. Like, we knew the form had been reinvented.
Yeah.
And that was exciting.
That's a perfect answer. Okay, Judd Apatow, you've been amazing. I'm so grateful for you. Thank you for giving me your time. However, when you were walking down the stairs late at night and one of your four cats, you're about to tread on it and you thought, in perfect screenwriting structure, save the cat. So you moved your foot and in doing so, you fell down the stairs over and over and over again. And it turns out you've got five flights of steps because you live in a very big house. And you just kept rolling down it like a sort of old-fashioned stuntman. But you didn't quite have the way to land in a way that wouldn't hurt yourself. And you broke 93% of all the bones in your body. And at the bottom of the stairs, you were dead. Land on your head, dead. And the cat padded over, walked over your body, went and had some milk. No idea what had gone on. I'm walking past. I got a coffin with me. You know what I'm like. I pop in on the upper towels. I'm like, how's everyone doing? I said, has anyone seen Judd? I just wanted to say hello. And they went, oh, I think he's having a nap at the bottom of the stairs. I go to the bottom of the stairs. I go, I don't think that's a nap. You're in a fucking state. You're all over the shop. So I have to get you, but you're all in bits. Like your limbs are all twisting stuff. I have to break off bits to try and get you in this coffin. I have to end up chopping you up. I get the whole family involved. We said, can I bring some knives? We chop you all up, pop you all in the coffin. Absolutely jammed in there. There's more of you than I was expecting. The coffin is full. There is only really enough room in this coffin for me to slide one DVD into the side with you, for you to take across to the other side. And on the other side, it's movie night every night. One night, it's your movie night. What film are you taking to show people in heaven when it's your movie night?
Dang, that's a thing. I'm going to say it's just what popped into my head. Animal House.
Wow. Okay.
You know, there's comedy, there's music. There's a lot of things. Cause you know, if that's the only one, it has to have a lot of stuff going on in it.
And no one else has brought it. You'll be welcome in heaven. People are going to have a party. Judd Apatow, you've been fucking brilliant. Is there anything you would like to tell people to watch, listen out for, read, etc.?
Yes. Well, please. Sicker in the Head is my book for charity for 826 that is coming out, and you can buy it now online or at a real bookstore. Better to get it at a real bookstore.
Yes.
But you could get an advanced copy now. That comes out in March. And brilliant. Then The Bubble comes out this spring on Netflix. And then in May, the two-part George Carlin documentary. And I disappear for about 2-3 years. I'm going to disappear. I realized I did too much over the last few years, and now I just shut it down. Nothing but poems that I don't show anyone, that I burn after I write them.
Judd Apatow, thank you so much for this. I really appreciate it. I hope you have a lovely death. Good day to you, sir.
You as well. Thank you. That was fun.
So that was episode 188. Head over to patreon.com/Brett Goldstein for the extra 20 minutes of chat, secrets and videos with Judd. Go to Apple Podcasts, put down 5 stars, but don't talk about the podcast. Talk about the film that means the most to you and why. That's what I want to read. I love to read that. So does my neighbour Maureen, and we really appreciate it. Thank you. And thank you for listening. Thank you so much to Judd for giving me all that time. Thanks to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to Acast for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Lydon for the photography. Come and join me next week for another brilliant guest. I'm not going to tell you who it is, but I can promise you it's another banger. I hope everyone is well. That is it for now. In the meantime, have a lovely week. And please, now more than ever, be excellent to each other. Sometimes I dream of becoming an actor. Have you ever dreamt of becoming an actor? Maureen, what is it you think I do for a living? Never mind. Sounds like you need the New York Film Academy. NYFA offers workshops,
BFA and MFA degrees and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, journalism and more, online and on campuses across the globe. To make films alongside industry professionals, explore more at nyfa.edu. Thanks, Brett.
Thank you, Maureen.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.